This is The End User, episode 161 for Tuesday, February 11th, Olympic Technology. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr.
Taylor, we've got a huge news up front here, and I'm not sure if there are any immediate the end user kind of implications, but Microsoft has announced that it is promoting its internal candidate, Satya Nadella.
To CEO of the company.
Yes, I should have said that, I guess.
Right. So this is the, I think it's just the third CEO in the history of Microsoft after Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer.
That's right. Solely number three, and they all happen to be on the board now, which is kind of interesting. I'm not terribly plugged into the business side of things, but I'm not sure I know of another company that has that all three CEOs on the board at the same time. Seems a little strange.
It's not all that uncommon, but the other big news here is that Bill Gates is stepping down as the chairman of the board.
Right, so another Microsoftie, John Thompson, is going to be the chairman of the board, and you know, I'm not sure how much weight that really carries, but you know, it's all like internal politics, so it's kind of hard to say what that actually means until we actually see some of the board operating in some way, right?
Well, everybody at Microsoft answers to the CEO, but the CEO answers to the board.
Right, and. But all of the CEOs are now on the board, and the chairman is John Thompson. So ultimately, the Nadella is on the board, and he can, you know, influence people. And he's got Bill Gates there with him, which I get the feeling, I'm not sure, but I get the feeling that Bill Gates is going to be there to kind of solidify Nadella as the new CEO. So being on the board together, they can make some decisions, and he's there to kind of give Nadella more sway until he really gets into the swing of things.
Right, sure. And that sort of transition is expected for any CEO, especially with a company that's held on to their CEOs as much as Microsoft has. But we've known that a new CEO was coming for a while, and once they made the decision, they said this is going to be an immediate change. So Steve Ballmer has stepped down, and Nadella has began taking over already.
Yeah, and so why do you think it wasn't Ballmer that's kind of ushering in Nadella? It seems like Gates is stepping in and helping out Nadella with some of the more immediate things, where you know he's not going to be used to being a CEO of a company the size of Microsoft. So Gates is going to come in and soothe some of the transitions. Why isn't it Ballmer? Ballmer's been the CEO for 10 years or so now.
Well, I've read a number of different opinions on this, and I really don't know enough about
sure
the corporate culture at Microsoft to understand exactly what's happening behind the scenes, but I did read an article by Paul Theriot, who had his own take on what he thinks is happening at Microsoft, and it sums it up pretty well. And if you're curious about it, I would suggest to go read that article, but also take it with a grain of salt, because he doesn't know about what's going on behind the scenes there any more than we do.
Yeah, and they talked about this at length with Paul Theriot, the guy you mentioned, over there at Windows Weekly. So if you're really into the internal politics of Microsoft, then first of all, I don't know what's wrong with you. And second of all, you want to go listen to Windows Weekly.
Yeah, hopefully you already do. But yes. That doesn't mean you have to stop listening to our show.
No.
And
it's like peanut butter and chocolate, Taylor.
Exactly. And the jelly in this sandwich might be the PC hardware manufacturing industry. And one of the biggest and oldest names in the personal computer, Sony, is actually going to sell off its VAIO PC business to Japan Industrial Partners.
Yeah, and that's interesting. I've always thought of VAIO as being kind of the highbrow Mac competitor in the PC land. And I don't think that they could find a place in the industry that had the kind of profits they were looking for.
Yeah, they definitely have been one of the more highly design-minded PC manufacturers, laptops especially. They, you know, 10 years ago, even up until 5 years ago, they were at the very forefront of thin and light laptop design. And yeah, at this point, basically everybody has caught up with them and been able to offer often a lower price for the same level of highly designed hardware.
Yeah, I remember when the MacBook Air first came out, the joke was that there was a Vio out there that could fit in the envelope, just like the Apple commercial. So people were taking their, I think it was Vio Z, if I remember. I'm not sure of that. But they were taking their Vio laptops and doing the same thing that Apple claimed to do for the first time in the commercial.
Yeah, I do remember that. That was a while. So they're still making some pretty nicely designed computers out there running modern Windows, and they're fairly competitive, although at the high end of the market. But the new owner, Japan Industrial Partners, will continue to produce Vio PCs, but they don't plan to market them outside of Japan in any time in the near future.
Yeah, and that's a shame, because that's really, they really made some quality computers from what I could see, having never had one. But just like you said, their eye for design was, or is, they're not going away, I guess, but they're going away in the United States. But their eye for design is something that I think was slightly unique in the PC industry. And I don't know Japan Industrial Partners, JIP. I don't know, I've never heard of this company. Usually we see, you know, one technology company trading and selling things to other technology companies, but I guess they're just, they're in Japan, so I just must not know of them because of that.
Yeah, I have never heard of them before either, but that doesn't mean anything really in terms of the future of this brand.
It just means we don't live in Japan. That's pretty much all that means.
That is true.
All right, so to finish out the top news, we have the end user public service announcement.
That's right. Breaking news just before we recorded the podcast, there has been a claim that Comcast's servers have been hacked. So the hackers potentially have access to any Comcast users' online accounts as well as their TV accounts. Basically, if you use Comcast and have an account that you would manage online, you should go ahead and change the password right away. Comcast has said there's no evidence to suggest any personal customer information was obtained, but this sounds like it may be a fairly big leak. Hopefully the data has been salted and hashed and they won't be able to have immediate access to personal information. But they still could.
Yeah, they still could. It's just if you're a Comcast customer in the United States, you should probably just change your password just to be safe. Even if these guys end up being jokers and they didn't actually get any information, when you learn that there is a potential breach out there, it's best just to go ahead and change your password. So that's probably what you should do. And we'll get some more details as we get a little more information over the next few days here.
That's right. But yeah, you should definitely change your password unless you trust Comcast when they tell you keep calm and carry on.
Yeah, or just don't trust them and change your password.
Well, I just assumed that no one trusts Comcast that much.
It's a lofty assumption. All right,
let's get away from that story and turn on the afterburner so that we can move even faster.
All right, so we all know about Google's Nexus 7 tablet, and the news here is that the Verizon edition is going to be arriving on February 13th, so just 3 days from now. It's going to be a 32-gig model, and it's going to be $350, so it's good to see that tablet make its way over to Verizon. It's been a while since the release of that thing, so I'm not sure what Verizon is up to, but it's good to see them get another device, I guess.
All right, Mozilla has finally released the first beta of Firefox for Windows 8. Now, this does not work with Windows RT, but if you use Windows 8, this new beta Firefox browser comes with touchscreen capability.
Yeah, and don't let the image in the blog post fool you. This is not a Firefox that's going to run on an RT device. It's only going to be the Windows 8 device. So that's a Surface Pro there you're looking at, I guess.
Now, Apple's iTunes Radio service has finally launched outside of the U.S. They're starting with Australia, and they're going to expand to a couple of more countries soon. And I'm a big proponent of iTunes Radio. They are a lot like Pandora, but the premium version that removes ads is only $25 a year, and then that includes cloud access to all of to your entire music library as well. If you're already in the iTunes ecosystem, iTunes Radio is a great thing, and that extra, actually, I don't know how much it costs internationally. It's $25 a year in the U.S., but I'm sure it will be $35 in Australia and probably roughly around that price everywhere else when it launches.
Yeah, so we'll see these dominoes starting to fall, and it's going to come to a lot more countries. So good to see that get a little wider adoption. So Newegg is launching a program similar to Amazon Prime. It's a $50 a year subscription, and you get the free expedited shipping. I'm not sure that Newegg has the kind of products to pull this kind of thing off like Amazon does, but I guess they're testing the waters to see what is going to happen if they roll out a business plan like this. It seems kind of interesting, so we'll see if it gets some uptick.
Now, one thing you'd be able to order from Newegg with your expedited shipping package is the brand new Asus Chromebox. It's $179. It runs Chrome OS, and it's a very small desktop PC that you can plug into a monitor or a TV, I suppose, if you wanted to. And it just runs Chrome OS, and it's silent. It's a pretty neat little box, and it's only $179.
It's an awesome little box. I love the industrial design on it is somewhere between utilitarian and, you know, that kind of ultra clean lines of a Macintosh of some sort. It's cool looking.
Now, Google, even though they're getting out of the smartphone hardware business, they're introducing another piece of hardware, which is also called a Chromebox, but don't get it confused. This is a business video conferencing system that starts at $1,000.
And another one that's caught my eye is Gigabyte's Brix Pro, which looks very cool. It's intended to be used with a quad-core CPU, and it's this little tiny box similar to the Chromebox, and it's only got a 2.5-inch bay in there, and so you can put a Core i7 in there. It's got an integrated GPU, and it just looks like a fantastic little device. And it's a bare-bones kit, so you're going to need to bring your own hard drive and memory, and going to need to bring your own operating system. But I would love to get a chance to play around with Media Center on one of these little things.
Yeah, it's a very impressive little box. It's not much bigger than the first Chromebox that we were talking about, but it has all of the power of a modern quad-core desktop PC.
All right, and with that, let's turn off the afterburners. Let's get into the end-user stories, and I guess I will start us out today. It was interesting. Have you been watching the Olympics, Mr. Marr?
I've been trying to follow along, but NBC is making it surprisingly challenging from a technical perspective to watch anything that's not a live broadcast, which is, of course, not even a live broadcast since they time delay it to put it on primetime television.
Yeah, I almost wish they would just broadcast everything live and I could just DVR it, you know, all this stuff that I wanted to watch and just do that. But, you know, it's been like this for a long time, so the tape delay, while kind of ridiculous if you take a step back from it in the context of the history of the TV industry, it kind of makes sense. And I feel like people expect it, right?
Well, if I can go off on a tangent about my problems here, the time delay, I agree, it's expected. It's for ratings. They absolutely should put their most popular programming on at a time when most people are going to watch it. But my problem is I thought that I would be able to use the NBC Sports app for the iPad and stream it to my Apple TV and watch highlights or full events streamed online on my TV. Now, I know that the NBC Sports iPad app had AirPlay capability to allow me to stream it over my Apple TV, and they removed the AirPlay for the Olympics.
That's just bizarre. So
they removed it.
Why would they give you the content in the first place just to say, oh, no, you can't watch it over there on that screen? That's too big a screen for you to watch it.
Furthermore, they've introduced at least 4 new apps just from NBC just for the Winter Olympics, and none of them work. They've all had serious bugs that have actually hindered me from watching the events I want to watch.
Yeah, so do you think, and we can make this a little segment, do you think we could not give NBC a monopoly to the coverage there? Would this be something that would solve these kinds of issues?
I don't know the answer to that. That would probably have to come down to the corporate policies of the International Olympic Commission.
Yep, because they sell the rights for a pretty penny to NBC.
Mm-hmm.
But you could make an argument that it is, in fact, not the right thing to do in the first place. And, you know, I guess it's an event in the world that the demand for it is so high, you can kind of do whatever you want.
I think that's the case.
Right? You've basically got infinite demand for the Olympics. There's no, you know, if you had companies who were competing for, I don't know, various events for their coverage or something like that. Like, you know, I'm thinking like the NFL deals, something along those lines. It almost seems like we could probably get them to compete with each other in a way, but I'm not sure how realistic that is.
Well, enough of me complaining about not being able to watch sports from my living room couch. I'm sure it's very different and potentially much worse for the people who are actually at the Olympics in Sochi, Russia.
Yeah, so NBC did a very interesting thing, and I was watching it as it aired for the first time live, and basically what they're saying is that the moment you walk out of the airplane and turn your phone on, Russian hackers will get you. And it's completely over the top. And I cannot believe that somebody with the supposed ethics of NBC ran a story like this. And I get it. To most people, this is kind of a niche story. But, you know, I look at this and what I was watching was literally impossible. The things that I saw on the broadcast, which I'll describe in a minute, just could not have happened. And it's unbelievable to me that this kind of nonsense got past whatever vetting process NBC has. So there's been an interesting kind of fallout because I'm sure many more people in the kind of technology industry saw that and said, well, hold on, that's crazy. That's not how things work. And the security researcher that they did the clip with has come out with a couple blog posts further explaining what is happening in the shooting of this particular clip. And it turns out that the clip was highly edited in a way to be completely misleading. So first of all, to anybody who hasn't paid attention to the news out there discrediting this NBC story, I am glad to say that is in fact not the case. And I guess secondly, I'll explain what kind of happened. And that's they demonstrated Richard Engel taking out a MacBook and an Android phone, and they showed him, he just like went to a malware site and downloaded an application. And what they didn't show you is that previously he had turned off the, you know, the Android warning. You know, there's that little checkbox that says that you can download apps from outside of the Google Play Store, and you have to go in there and uncheck that, and you have to do a bunch of stuff. And then finally, you have to intentionally go to a malware site and download the malware package, and it's just completely over the top, and I don't know what NBC's angle is in publishing this kind of nonsense, but it really upset me to see that on a national stage, and I know there's a very large audience out there that saw that and will never think twice of it, and all they think is crazy Russian hackers can hack your MacBook if you take it out of your bag. And that is not a good message to send to a lot of people when we even have some tensions with Russia still kind of hanging over from the Cold War. So I really, really don't like the NBC piece that they had on air. And I was heartily encouraged to see the security researcher come forth and post a couple blog posts further explaining exactly what he's talking about.
I agree. It's important and it's interesting to see that the security researcher has been so open about what it was that he did and how that was manipulated.
Yeah, that's so great of him to kind of step out into public and say, whoa, okay, let me explain, and then, you know, explain exactly what happened instead of the abbreviated version, which I feel was quite irresponsible. On the other hand, this guy, I think, was quite responsible with the information he's talking about. So, good to see. All right, well, that ends my rant. Should we move on to some I'm hot and bothered now.
Well, so this has just been the week of Sochi rants.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, we got some good ones in there. So
apparently the technology being used in Sochi is basically fine and exaggerated to be terrible, whereas the technology that NBC is using to deliver us the Sochi events is terrible and they're pretending it's fine.
So we learned recently that Visa and MasterCard are planning to roll out the chip and pin style of credit card that we do not have here in the United States and that pretty much everybody else in the world has, that protects the consumers by forcing them to hold a secret in their head, a pin, and making the credit card number useless without the pin. And this, pretty much the U.S. is the only place where you don't have chip and pin in the first place. So I guess given the recent data breaches of Target and other companies, I guess Visa and MasterCard are starting to think about what kind of system they should roll out. We don't really know if it'll be compatible with the other chip and pin systems in Europe and the like. And I guess they're just starting to look at that. They say they've got a roadmap and their changeover date is going to be sometime in October 2015. So what do you think? Is that a good move?
Well, I remember this system being implemented over 10 years ago when I was last in Europe. Oh, that's depressing. But it is unusual to me because it seems like PIN numbers, especially when it comes to the way we use PIN numbers to interact with banks in the U.S., would seem to be a fairly insecure method of verification, right? If you go to any ATM, someone could have put a camera in it that can steal your PIN number. Or a lot of people just use really simple PIN numbers and they don't think twice about whether those numbers could be hacked. The law of large numbers dictates that if anyone had access to enough cards, they would be able to get some of their PIN numbers right. But I guess it's a giant leap past the signature-based system that we have here now.
Yeah, the signature-based system is kind of insane, right? You just kind of scribble some craziness on a piece of paper and they say, okay, well, now it's up to you to pay the bill. And what ended up being is that Visa and MasterCard kind of take on the risk up to a certain amount for you so that when you use your card, if it has been used fraudulently, then you're not really liable and the credit card company has to hash out the details of the transaction with the merchant. I'm not sure about this because I think ideally what I would want to do is take my credit card and swipe it and just walk away and have the companies figure it out, right? It seems kind of annoying for me to have a PIN every time I make a transaction of some sort.
I agree, and I wonder if there isn't some technology that we can use to just simply leapfrog this. I could pretty easily imagine, maybe not a self-powered chip in your credit card, but let's say you swipe your credit card and then it connects to a power source and a verification system, and your credit card itself has a fingerprint reader inside it. So you have to swipe and verify your fingerprint as you're swiping it, and that would be a much more secure system. Although I'm sure that could be spoofed as well. But the thing is, we're switching to a new system that the rest of the world has had 20 years to secure and then break that security. I don't understand why we've been doing it our own way all this time. Let's just leapfrog to a newer, more secure system.
Yeah, it's almost too late for this, right? Yeah, I think you're right. Maybe we should be looking toward the next thing and not at this particular thing. I could see some kind of, this would be interesting, maybe we could get into some kind of certificate authority situation where You know, MasterCard is the certificate authority, and they can issue you a cert for your card. And then on the credit card terminal, there's some kind of certificate reader or something like that that would verify that that card is actually your card. But I don't know. I haven't thought that one through, obviously. But there has to be something better that we can do that is not chip and pin, although it does work a little better. So I guess why wouldn't we do it now? Is it really too late?
I'm not sure. Apparently, Visa and MasterCard have this roadmap, and it's very important to them. But I would hope that we're at a point early enough in the transition where it wouldn't be unreasonable to ask for more security.
Yeah. And I do think, as much as I say it's annoying, there is a flip side to that coin. And you're right. It's that we can get a little bit more security. And just thinking about all of the automated bill pay and stuff that I have going on, if my credit card changes, it's actually a pretty big hassle to change my credit card everywhere. But if I'm protected by a PIN, the thing is, even if I'm protected by my PIN, I'd probably still want to change all of them. But I don't know. I guess this is it'll be a decent in-between, perhaps. And I'll be looking forward to what smarter people than us have come up with to solve this kind of problem. But clearly, having just a number be connected to some source of your money is not secure enough in this world today, and we need to figure that out. That's an unsolved problem for the moment, as far as I'm concerned.
I agree with you.
All right, let's move into a kind of mini feature here. What's going on with Bitcoin these days, Taylor?
A lot is going on with Bitcoin.
Tons.
Last week, we reported that Mint.com has started to allow certain Bitcoin banks to be included in your investment section of your online portfolio, which is only monitored and to a certain extent managed through Mint. But to do anything serious regarding those accounts, you have to use the primary. It's just letting you monitor your accounts and keep track of your investment in Bitcoin. And I commented last week that the fact that they made it an investment was interesting, and I think it was the right call. Bitcoin is in itself just a currency. It's just a way for you to store money, but it has been one of the most volatile currencies in the history of the world. And in that sense, it is an investment, and it's a rather risky one. You've got a lot of return if you bought Bitcoin a year ago. But the news this week is that the stock price has dropped by over $100 in the last week and over $400 since it peaked at around $1,100 per Bitcoin. Now, the reason it's dropped so precipitously this week is because one of the major exchanges, Mt. Gox, has suspended its Bitcoin withdrawals. They claim that there was an error that was causing certain transactions to be dropped, and so it had to completely freeze the assets under its protection while it addresses this technical issue. Now, Mt. Gox and other proponents of Bitcoin have been arguing about whose fault this is, but it's almost certainly not Bitcoin's fault because the cryptography of Bitcoin has been examined very closely and found to be pretty secure. But regardless of whose fault that is, the stock price has dropped very significantly in the last week.
Yeah, it's such a volatile currency. You know, a little teeny bump in the road like this, which is exactly, you know, what I think this is. If you ask me a month from now about the great Mt. Gox bug of 2014, I'm not sure I'm going to even remember. The value of it is so tied to the public perception of the people who have it, I suppose, that it's just, it remains extremely volatile in its young life. And I don't think that's going to change no matter what Mt. Gox ends up doing. It's going to be a volatile kind of currency.
That's true. And so that ties in with a number of other things. Two new lawsuits have hit the courts over the past week. One is that Prosecutors in Florida are charging three men associated with a different Bitcoin exchange for basically moving money around without the proper licensing and paying the proper fees and potentially taxes on it. And that is a novel instance in U.S. courts. And I'm sure that there will be more to come. But another one has to do with a manufacturer of Bitcoin mining hardware. They make these little boxes. The company is called Butterfly Labs. It's designed specifically to efficiently mine for Bitcoins. Now, the thing is, it's become so computationally expensive to mine Bitcoins that it's very difficult to gain a return on your investment except at the highest, most efficient levels of computing, which is why people are buying these little mining boxes that can cost tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. That's the investment that it is required to make money back on the electricity that you spend just mining Bitcoins. Now, the fact that the price of Bitcoins has dropped $400 in the last few months means that a lot of these people mining Bitcoins will probably be turning off some of their equipment because, you know, for $1,100 a Bitcoin, you can afford to spend a lot more electricity than if it's at $700 a Bitcoin. And so the other lawsuit is this manufacturer of these boxes is being charged with fraud. They're either taking too much money or not delivering enough product. Now, all of this ties together to my point that Bitcoin is an investment. And with investments, you can be optimistic, you can be bullish, or you can be pessimistic, which they call bearish. So if you're bullish on Bitcoin, and I'm not making any value statements about whether you should be optimistic or pessimistic on the long-term prospects of Bitcoin. But what I will say is that all of these news stories that have collectively caused the price of Bitcoin to crash, none of them will affect the viability of Bitcoin in the long term. Yeah. So if you are bearish on Bitcoin and you have already invested in it, you might want to think about getting out. It's probably not the best time. I'm sure the price will go back up before it crashes. I'm not saying it's going to crash. I'm just saying you think it's going to crash if you're bearish. If you're bullish, this is a great time to invest in Bitcoin because if you believe in the long-term viability of this currency slash investment, none of these stories will affect it. So it's the price has crashed as a result of market fluctuations, and you should buy into this investment sooner than later. Again, I'm not making any value statements about whether you should own Bitcoin or not own Bitcoin. You have to make that decision for yourself. But what I am saying is that this is a very interesting time for it. You should be thinking about buying or selling more than you have been for the last few months.
I think it's just still young in a way that it is just going to fluctuate like this. It's a very insular community. You know, there aren't a lot of people who are holding and trading Bitcoins. And so any little tiny thing that happens will either send it to skyrocket or send it to the basement. So it's just super volatile in its young life. It'll be interesting to see as it matures if it stables out or not. If it doesn't, that may be a death knell for Bitcoin, right? So we'll just kind of have to wait and see what happens with that.
It may be, but one last piece of legitimacy that Bitcoin has gotten this week is Microsoft's Bing search will now automatically convert Bitcoins as with any other currency like you can do in Google.
Yeah, so you can type in, 5 USD to BTC, and it'll do the calculation for you. So that's cool. I've got to imagine that Google's going to be adding this soon.
I'm sure that they will. I'm sure that it will be very soon. But Microsoft was the first.
Yeah, and we'll see Wolfram Alpha after both of them, I'm sure. So, Mr. Marr, out of the Bitcoin news and into the green tech story of the week. Well, what do you got for us this week?
All right, so this one is a little out there. It's off the beaten path, but if you are interested in climatological data regarding global warming, you can now access some of it directly from Google Maps. So they've added a layer on Google Maps that added the data set that tracks global temperature data based on region and time. This is a set from the University of East Anglia's Climatic Research Unit, and the data set is called CRUTE M4. But what it means is basically you can overlay these squares over Google Maps and look at mean surface temperature over time throughout the last century. So if you are just interested in the particular local effects that climate change has had in your area, or if you're interested in the overall trends at large, if you're curious about how significant the impact of climate change has been over the last 100 years or so, you can now do that just by going to maps.google.com.
Yeah, that's neat to see that, because I feel like there's an often misconception of confusing weather and climate, right? I've often had to talk to people about the difference between weather and climate. And you can kind of point to this and say, look, you know, this is climate. And you can see it laid out on a nice map. That's definitely a pretty nice presentation.
That's absolutely right.
So, all right, let's move into our tip of the week. And as usual, some combination of you and Life Hackers got us covered here. What's going on?
All right, so we pulled this from our archives, but I tagged it a little while ago as a great guide from Lifehacker, as usual, on how to remote control your computer. They just ran down all of the information that they have. You know, what's the easiest way to access your computer remotely? What's the best way? Do you want to pay? Do you want to not pay? Do you have Windows? Do you have Android? Do you have Apple? Are you inside your own home network? Do you want to use the internet? They just explain all the different permutations of that for if you want to access your PC from another device. And it's something that not necessarily everybody would want to know how to do, but a lot of people who don't necessarily want to do the research and develop the technical expertise to, say, be able to manage a command line from SSH or any of the other ways to virtually compute from elsewhere, this gives you the easy options, the complex options, the free options, the best options, and it's very thorough.
Yeah, and it's kind of nice. I like how they go through the different complexity of options. That's nice to have some simpler alternatives for people who can't hack it, and then for the true geeks out there, they've got a little more complicated solutions. It's cool.
Yeah, so if you have any thoughts about trying to access your computer from another device, whether it's in your own house or from across the world, this is a good guide to get you to do that.
And personally, this is even beyond the scope of this article. I have a VPN server on my Windows Home server, and I use that to get into my network and then remote desktop into my machine. Taylor, do you have any kind of remote access set up for you?
I don't have any remote access over the web, but these days I've been teaching myself SSH.
Cool, yeah, so you can at least
to do everything from the command line, yeah.
Yeah, get a little shell open. Cool, all right, and so our app pick of the week, you've got a oldie that I haven't used in a while in Media Monkey. What have they added since I last used them many years ago? I should check them out again, huh?
Well, I can't tell you what they've added since you last used it, because I've never used it. It's a media player for Windows, and their latest edition, 4.1, was just released, and they had new capabilities for syncing with Android devices and iOS 7 devices. And they've also added a new UPnP interface with DLNA.
Yeah, I always get that backwards too. I always want to say DNLA instead of DLNA.
It flows off the tongue easy, but
it definitely
DLNA with on-the-fly conversion for file formats. And it gets Lifehacker's seal of approval. I've never used it. I probably won't use it. But if you were waiting for any of those features, or probably a whole bunch of other features, you should check out MediaMonkey if you are a Windows user.
Yeah, DLNA has a lot of potential for what it can do, depending on if you have DLNA clients that are available. Like, you know, some TVs now are DLNA compliant, and you can sling media to them, and you can do that through MediaMonkey if that's your chosen, or one of many chosen solutions. So it's pretty cool. I'm going to have to go back and maybe put this on the server and see if I can get any goodness out of that. And all right, let's get down to our last story of the week. It is our kicker, ladies and gentlemen. We couldn't leave this week without talking about Flappy Bird.
We had to talk about Flappy Bird.
So this is a very strange story, and I am not sure where this came from or how this really came about, but there is a quite simple game that used to be on iOS and Android at this point called Flappy Bird, and the developer allegedly bought reviews to kind of spike their search results in the App Store, and
it got away from him.
Yeah, basically, I think that's it. It kind of got away from him somehow, but it ended up being very, very popular. And so, despite the fact that that may or may not have happened, people did actually end up liking the game, and it got quite a following. And strangely, not too long after that, the creator of the game tweets that he is removing Flappy Bird from the App Store, which I can't really explain. Apparently, if you parse the numbers a little too closely, which I'm questioning some news sources who are reading so much into Flappy Bird, but apparently he was making around $50,000 a day, and so I don't know what happened to make him decide to not do that anymore, but just a very strange story.
$50,000 a day, and again, that's a rough estimate, but those are just through ads. This was a free game.
Yeah, so it seemed like to me, if that was actually the case, then he had hit the big time, and I don't know why he would stop that.
He didn't want this game to make him famous. He did not like the attention that he was getting from this game.
Yeah, so I'm a little confused by it, but apparently it's been quite popular. And so popular, in fact, that somebody decided to sell their iPhone that had Flappy Bird installed on it. And they were fetching a pretty penny for that.
Yeah, that's right. I will definitely sell my iPhone 5 to any of the end user listener who is interested in purchasing it for $1,000. It does have a working copy of Flappy Bird on it.
But don't you have to give up your account for that?
For $1,000, I think I could work it out.
Yeah, true. So, lastly, in the strange world that is the internet, if anything happens on the internet, you can be assured, at least in the last couple months, that something Doge meme will have been involved. So there is, in fact, a clone of Flappy Bird, if you would like to play a game that has some semblance to Flappy Bird, called Flappy Doge. So we've got a link in the show notes if you are interested to see what the game looks like, and you can play it with the Doge dog. If you don't know what Doge is, then you'll have to look that one up. That's another story for another time, I suppose.
Go to knowyourmeme.com. Doge is spelled D-O-G-E, and they will explain everything for you. We're not going to explain Doge to you today.
And be prepared to be confused. The the Doge meme is something I don't understand myself. So if you've never heard of it, there is no hope. So anyway, if you at least want to see some semblance of the game, it's Flappy Doge. There you go. All right, well, if somebody wanted to send you a message, perhaps a picture of the Doge, how would they go about doing that?
Oh, God, I cannot answer that question. Do not send me a Doge picture. I do not want any Doge pictures, and I will not tell you how to reach me with Doge pictures.
I implore every single listener to tweet at Taylor with a picture of the Doge dog.
All right. Well, if you're going to tweet me the Doge dog, you know, at least at least make it a relevant meme. You know, add some text to it, some much wow dumb stuff. Please attempt to make me laugh and not cry.
Much tweet at Taylor phone. So if you wanted to get at me, I am at
already.
We're getting it started already. So if you wanted to get at me, I am at Chris Hale Barnes. So feel free to send me more meaningful messages than pictures of Doge.
Send them all to Chris. Chris wants all the Doge. Much Doge. Wow. So meme.
So that'll do it for this week. So thank you everyone for listening to the show. And of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, over there at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts. You can have a listen to Entertainment 2.0, seen in HD, the movie podcast, and Home On, and soon to come to the Digital Media Zone, the Dogecast. You can send us some feedback. Our email is theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can follow us on Twitter. Together, we are at theenduser. You can join us in the chat room as we record the show live every Monday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Moore.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.
All Doge, all time. Much podcast.